Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
It's that time again for the Your Favorite Band podcast. I am your good friend, Bran, and with me is my favorite friend that's a boy. Who is it?
I'm a boy? Yeah, it's me. It's me.
It's Dave.
It's me, it was, Dave the boy.
I started to say my favorite person, and then I was like, nope, that's my wife.
Yeah, but you're already doing fine by saying my favorite friend, and then you said my favorite friend that's a boy.
Yeah, well, my wife is my friend, too. We don't need to get into the nitty-gritty. Hey, Dave, welcome back. It's so good to be with you, and it's an exciting another episode of the Your Favorite Band podcast. How, scale of 1 to 14, how excited are you?
2 weeks? How about 15?
I love that.
Put it right over the top.
Dave, per usual, some quick house clean. Like, listen, we got to clean this house, and we got to do
the house,
now.
Yeah.
It's filthy. Now, real quick, we got a couple of really great reviews over the past week since we asked for you guys to go onto iTunes and review, which you should do. And I would like to say, there's one guy, Skeptic as well is his name, and he says, love listening to these two interview others. Thank you. Another person said, love the style of this podcast. More than just people talking. It's well put together. Hey, thank you. I'm glad people are getting it. And if you have thoughts along the same line of thought, or like if you just want to tell us it sucks, either one of those is good. Although we've only gotten
we're gluttons for punishment.
No one stars. So that's a challenge for you out there that are really trying to ruin our ruin the way in which we're doing going about things. please don't. Please don't do the one star. 5 stars will be great. So yeah, Dave, go on to iTunes. Even if you don't use iTunes, iTunes again has magic dust that they sprinkle through the internet.
It changes each week for you. Like, the description of this is it dust every time?
Yeah. No, it's not dust. Sometimes it's stew.
That's right.
Anyways, do it, and we'll be thankful for it. Hey, Dave, another thing that I was thinking about today is if somebody's like, we've gotten a couple of people that have been emailing us saying, hey, I'm really wanting this band, and because of that, our next episode is with a band called Pianos Become the Teeth. And
wonderful.
the reason why I found out about it is because somebody emailed them to us, and I was like, this band's great. We're getting them on the show. So if you want that to be your story, Dave, tell them the email address.
What a blessing that would be to have that be what happened.
Yeah, it's your favorite band podcast at gmail.com. You can email us, and if we like the bands, it takes 2 seconds to email us, and it takes us 2 seconds to email them.
What happens is we get all these requests in, and then me and Brian, I'll fly down to Greenville, and we'll sit in a room with some headphones, and we kind of just listen through, and then we'll just go, maybe.
And that's another thing. It's getting expensive. So if you want to help us out, you can go to yourfavoritebandpodcast.com, click on the donate tab. That'd be really great. Hey, Dave, we got a great episode planned today. Guess who's on the show?
I sure would like to know.
Oh, let's let him introduce himself.
My name's Dan Koch, and I am the guitarist and principal songwriter for the band Sherwood.
Oh, man. Hey, Dave, without further ado, let's just get right into this one, because it's going to be a doozy. Dan grew up with his parents, who are both themselves musicians. But it was the good old rock and roll that finally got him hooked on music himself.
Yeah, I grew up in a fairly musical house. Both my parents were musicians, are musicians. My mom sang on some records in college. My parents performed at weddings and funerals and some Sunday mornings at church. So I have a lot of memories of like them very last minute, you know, prepping for some song at someone's wedding that they are like just learning that day. like tons of memories like that, which very much feels like my personality. So that was kind of the household, and I really fell in love with music when I found rock and roll, like hard rock in fifth grade, Smashing Pumpkins, Nirvana, Soundgarden, all that stuff. And that was when I was like, oh man, music. And I quit playing the piano around seventh grade to start playing drums, which I really regret. And then about a year later, I started playing guitar, started writing songs around 10th grade, you know, that kind of a thing. So my first band was called Permanent Holiday. I was the drummer. I was a punk band. The two bands I was in high school were Permanent Holiday and Ignorant Youth, and my dad's joke was that both of them described the lives of myself and my friends, which is a dad joke, but pretty accurate. So I was a drummer. I was in that band for 6 months, Permanent Holiday, and then I got kicked out, and I told myself at the time that I got kicked out because they were jealous of my skills, but upon adult reflection, I'm pretty sure I just was like really lazy and didn't help load out at the shows and talk to my friends, and I was probably just kind of an asshole. So I don't blame them now, but I was mad at the time. I was in another band in high school called Ignorant Youth, as I said, and then in college, Nate from Sherwood and I were actually in a band called the Renomes, as in R-A hyphen gnomes. We sounded like the Ramones, but we wrote like joke songs, like For a Good Time, Call 911. We had a song called Lord of the Renomes, Fellowship of the Gnome. It's very silly. I played drums and Nate played guitar. Yeah, it was fun. So I was the drummer only for about 6 months, and then Joe was a friend of ours. He was in another local band, and he was like, hey, if you guys ever need an auxiliary percussionist. And we just basically laughed at him because he's such a better drummer than me. So we only had one guitarist, and I just switched to play second guitar. And I had already kind of been the songwriter anyway. So that was all like way before, you know, a year or two before the first Sherwood, the Sherwood EP.
So Sherwood is born. But how did they settle on that band name? And what kind of sound did they adopt while experiencing the music scene of 2002 America?
Well, that was just, it was this joke we had about a side project we would start someday where, you know how Dark Side of the Moon is supposedly goes along with Wizard of Oz if you start them at the same time? We were going to do that, but we would do it on purpose. And my favorite movie growing up was Disney's Robin Hood. So I wanted to like write an album that went along to Robin Hood, but we would just, oh, we'll call it Sherwood, ha ha ha. And then we had to change our name. We were like, oh, that's a way better name. So we'll just use that. So there are a lot of songs that will never see the light of day that existed and that are recorded from before the Sherwood EP. And I was just actually listening to them, I don't know, a couple months ago. I found them on my hard drive. And it's so emo. Like, they were so, so emo. Like 5 minute songs with no choruses. Just like tons of Further Seems Forever, tons of Mineral influence. And really just kind of unfocused. And it's pretty laughable now. But I was really steeped in that kind of earlier emo scene. And then also I realized too that we picked up a lot from some friends' bands of ours that were also in the San Luis Obispo, California area. We named one of our songs on the first EP, The Push Game, which is actually a riff that my friend Josh wrote for his band, The Push Game, and we just called the song that, and I just stole it. I mean, I'm sure he told me I could, but there's a lot of that. Like, a lot of, we were really influenced by what our friends were doing around us. One of the things that I remember us talking about, even in the early days, was that compared to all our friends' bands and all the bands that, you know, we met on the road, like, we were college kids by comparison. You know, we all met at college, and we were kind of nerdy, and we did a couple things using those skills. So we figured out there was the time where mp3.com had kind of faded, and MySpace music wasn't really going yet. And there was this like 1 year where purevolume.com is where everybody went to find new bands, like in the kind of emo punk indie scene. And we figured out that at 9 p.m. Pacific or midnight Eastern, the top songs or top artists of the day on the front page, the top 10 would reset. And so we were like, okay, is there a way we can like juice our plays up after midnight? So we figured out that we could go to the Cal Poly library, which had like 100 computers, and we would just go and we would just log on, play all 7 songs on our Pure Volume page, move to the next computer. And then we would start at 9:15 p.m. Pacific, number one on Pure Volume. And then we would sort of slowly drop down throughout the day as people went to other pages and listened to other bands. But we got a lot of fans doing that. I mean, I'm sure thousands and thousands of people heard our music by us just totally gaming the system. And then eventually Pure Volume got big enough that it didn't work anymore, and so we stopped doing that. But that's the kind of thing we were doing. Another example is then MySpace started meaning a lot for music. And so if we were going to be, say, on tour with Waking Ashland, that band from Tooth and Nail, we would, before the tour, go to all of Waking Ashland's MySpace friends. So it might be like maybe 8,000 friends they had. And I got so fast using like a PC with like no software on it, like you'd have at a school, like a school computer. I could send the maximum allowable 400 MySpace messages in about an hour. And then we started, Nate started Sherwood Street Team official MySpace page, and we sent another 400 some days. So we would send them to, so every single person who was friends with that band on MySpace would get an email from us before the tour, not only telling them about the show, but also saying, hey, we're going to be at that show, check out our music. And then we sort of hoped maybe we'll sell them a CD or a t-shirt and make another connection with a fan. And even these reunion shows that we've been playing that we'll get to later, I still meet people who we first reached out to in those days directly. Yeah, and it's crazy that stuff can stick with people, but we were just trying to kind of game the system mostly at that point. I mean, that was really a different era. I mean, we're talking 2003, 2004, 2005, and in those days, you could get in a van and go play shows at places where people would go to shows. I mean, it was just a totally different sort of media landscape than there is now. So, but we practiced a lot. I mean, I remember being in college and feeling like I'm in college, but I'm not having a college experience because we practiced 4 or 5 nights a week. So it was either practice, and then when practice was over, we would go to the library, I mean, at 9:30 and do our little tricks. And you know, we became friends just hanging out together, but that was basically the nexus of my social group for college. And I dropped out after 3 years to tour, and I didn't finish until 8 years later.
Dan decided early on that he wants to do music with his life, maybe even a little too confidently. What was it like doing the do-it-yourself band life prior to the first signing with the Militia Group?
Actually, almost the very beginning, I would say 2002. So Sing But Keep Going came out in 2005, the first full length. And 3 years before that, we were all in. I mean, I think that we were naive about it. I remember thinking, I'm not going to do a study abroad program at college because the band is going to take me to Europe for free. And that did end up happening, but it shouldn't have. Like, that's not common. That was not a reasonable thing to assume for me. I lucked out, right? But it doesn't work that way for most bands, even most bands of our size. The only reason we went to Europe is because MySpace Records at that point was willing to burn a bunch of money to try and get us to work in England. And so, yeah, it was, I mean, from the very beginning, I was like, at least Nate and I were like, we will do this. This will be our full-time job for years. And I think there was a lot of naivety, but we did sort of luck out. Oh my gosh, man. So we got $7 a day for food each. That was our allotment. We drove around in a 15-passenger van. What we would do is we had a rule to incentivize people to sell more CDs. If you sold a CD to somebody outside of the show, like I think we actually at one point had a 50 yards from the door rule. Like, so people walking across the street, or we would go to malls during the day before the show. If you sold a CD, you got to keep the money for food. So the band would cover the $1 to print the CD. And this was the way we incentivized ourselves. And so we actually sold like 4,000 or 5,000 copies of our first EP. And this is before really iTunes. So that was almost all physical. And, you know, and we did that at Warped Tour and stuff as well. So we did. So I still have this like deep down fear of mall security because of all the times that we got kicked out of malls for going up to people and trying to sell them a Sherwood CD. So, I mean, it really, that's what it was. I have one other kind of greatest hit story from that era, because we were so poor. We made so little money, we really couldn't afford hotels. So we would stay with anybody. I mean, we would stay anywhere we could stay. And there was this one particular time where we were on the East Coast, and Nate was like, hey, I got this friend, she's going to put us up, you know, she's got a shower and an extra bed, and it will be great. But the problem was, it was like a 6-hour drive overnight to get to her place. And the whole time we're driving, we're trying to get him to tell us who this girl is, and he won't really say anything. And we finally arrive, like the sun is out, it's probably 6 a.m. We arrive at her place and we knock on the door and she doesn't answer. Nobody's there. And he's like, Nate, can you call her? He tries calling her. Nothing. Nate's like, all right, well, looks like that window's open. Mikey, let's put you up in there. So I have this photo somewhere on a hard drive of, it was in this, like, there were steps up to the apartment. So someone's lifting Mikey and holding his feet up to like maybe 7 feet up. He's, you know, butt sticking out, climbing into a window. And then he pulls his head back through the window and has a photo, like a framed photo of her and her child. And she's like, Nate, does she have a kid? We all look at Nate. Nate's like, I don't know. We're like, you don't know? Who is this person we're staying at? He's like, don't worry about it. So he's like, Mikey, get in there, open the door. And so Mikey opens the door. He's like, guys, I don't know if I should be in here. I should maybe wipe my fingerprints off of that picture. And we were like, what the hell? What are you talking about? He's like, I think she might have been robbed. So now we're all in the apartment, and it's totally torn up. Like, it's just very, very messy. Clothes everywhere, sort of drawers kind of open. And someone starts saying, like, what if she's like dead in the bathtub? Like, what is going on here? Where's the kid? And so someone like pulls the shower curtain back. And there's nothing, no one in there. Okay, phew. But we're just like, we got to get out of here. So we just like wipe our prints off and we leave. And so we found out later that the girl's brother had been in like a car accident that day. And so, or the night before. So she had to drive and leave. But the funny thing is, we finally got Nate to tell us how he knew her. And the reason he wasn't saying anything is because he had dated her in junior high over the internet. He had never met her in person. And they had met in a Five Iron Frenzy chat room. It was just insane. That's how desperate we were for places to stay.
Sing But Keep Going is the album that really got the band going, eventually selling over 20,000 copies. What was the difference in fan base with the release and success of this album? And what was it like playing songs from this album alongside the craziness of Warped Tour?
Yeah, there was a difference. I mean, I think it sold like 12 or 13,000 copies in its first year, which sounds like a lot. But the practical difference on our end was like, we were able to get an old RV for like 10 grand or something that used to be on the Road Rules show on MTV. So we were in an RV and we were able to pay like one or two people to come along with us at this point. But we, you know, we weren't like really making money. Like, we weren't actually saving any money. But we were able to stay on the road much more comfortably. I remember those years, like 05, 06 as being really fun years. Probably the best tour we did was with Daphne Loves Derby and This Providence. Did a whole U.S. tour with them. And I think that this was kind of the time when Sherwood fans became sort of like an actual obvious reality, you know, where it wasn't just like, well, we can maybe convince 20 people to come tonight and four or five people knew us from Pure Volume and showed up. This was like, oh, you know, on the West Coast, 100 people will come out and know the songs. We had this little group of fans in Seattle called the Sherwood Forest. They would wear like super tight shorts and like put their arms up like trees. It only lasted a few years. They all moved away. We really hoped that that would catch on nationwide, but it never quite did. And then like, you know, Utah and California, we would have pretty big shows. We started selling out a couple smaller venues like Kirby Court in Salt Lake City and stuff like that. So that was cool. That was like a fun, that was a really good period where it was like, oh, this is kind of starting to work. We're getting better. We're playing better live. And there's some people who care about this, you know. So Warped Tour is its own kind of animal. Sometimes I marvel at like what a role Warped Tour has played in my life. So we did 2004 and 2006. We did basically the whole summer both times. We had pretty different experiences. In 2004, we worked our way on through the help of Jonathan Jones from Waking Ashland. Later, We Shot the Moon as well. He basically convinced the person who was running this small stage, the Uproar stage, to let us come sell merch if we helped set up and tear down the stage every day. And then we would play about every fourth or fifth day. But so we would have to show up. Doors would open. You know, they would start setting up the tents around 7 or 8 a.m. and they would tear them down around 10 p.m. And then we'd have to drive overnight in the van ourselves, you know, 4 to 6 hours to the next Warped Tour spot, and then sleep in the van, get up, and do it again. And on top of that, the first 5 days of that Warped Tour in 04 were in Florida. So we had 90-degree weather and 95% humidity. And we were working 15-hour days, basically, and then driving ourselves overnight and sleeping in a van. And I almost quit the band. I mean, it was insane. I've never worked harder at anything physically in my life. And I probably never will, unless I'm sent to a labor camp or something. It was totally insane. So that was like 04. Then in 06, we did the whole Warped Tour as well. But at that point, we had signed with MySpace. We hadn't put out the third record yet or the second record yet. But we did have like a regular time to play every day, and we had the RV instead of a van. We still had to drive ourselves, but that was much better. So a few highlights from Warped Tour. I became friends with Fat Mike from NoFX, and I wrote their set list when they played in Washington. And coincidentally, I met my wife that day. We became friends, you know, to this day with members of Emery, Motion City Soundtrack, Classic Crime, bunch more bands. So like so many of my friends came from Warped Tour. I have two stories to tell you guys from Warped Tour. The first one happened on the day that I met my wife when I wrote the NoFX set list. So we were playing on the Ernie Ball stage, which that day had kind of like a hill style amphitheater around it. So, you know, people could be sitting down at your eye level watching you, you know, about 40 yards away or something. So Mikey, the way that he used to play on stage was pretty wild, you know, a lot of energy. And so he would like play keys, but he also played hand percussion. And so sometimes when the spirit moved him, you could say, he would like throw the tambourine into the crowd. And he does that at one point in the show. And he hits this girl right on her left leg, like right, like on her shin. And we sort of see it happen. And then when the song's over, the girl comes up and she like gives us a tambourine back. We make a couple jokes about it. Like, thank you so much. Can't believe that happened. So sorry. Well, a few songs later, you know, Mikey throws a tambourine again. He hits the same girl on the same leg in the same spot. It's like 40 yards away. I can't believe that. So she was very kind. We gave her a shirt and a CD or something, and you know, sorry about that. Okay, and the other story actually starts. It starts the summer before when we played this weird festival in Bakersfield and we were watching 30 Seconds to Mars play, and I was in kind of a saucy mood, I guess. And so at one point, Jared Leto breaks a string and is like, hey, we're going to start that song over. And I sort of make, I'm like, I don't know, 50 rows back in the crowd. It's not a very big festival. And I'm making the, like, you know, no, don't do it, you know, sort of like hand slicing underneath the neck motion, just kind of being a wise ass. And he's like, hey, Beardo. He's like, I'd like to see you do this with your band. And then I just sort of point to the side and I'm like, we're on next, because we were playing right after them on the next stage over. And then we're playing our set, you know, half hour later, 45 minutes later. And we see this, our stage is obviously smaller than the stage that 30 Seconds to Mars was playing on. And there's, you know, maybe 100 people watching us. And then we see like 75 kids coming behind a flag bearing Jared Leto. He's like carrying this big 30 Seconds to Mars flag and has these kids like rallying behind him to come to our set and intimidate us or whatever. So I try and like shake his hand because I, at this point, I'm feeling very anxious. I'll be perfectly honest. There's like a mob of, you know, Bakersfield high schoolers. Try to shake his hand. He won't shake my hand. He goes back. The kids kind of leave, but like our friends who are there are like watching our backs, you know, making sure no one tries anything. We finish the set. I'm starting to have a panic attack because I don't like confrontation. I don't know why I was being such a smartass that day for someone who doesn't like confrontation, but I was. And we get word from the promoter that Jared wants to say hi and that I should go over to their bus. But we had also heard that his brother was really mad, the drummer. So we go over there and we bring like two of our biggest guys with us. Like we had, like, Nate's a really big guy. He's like a former football player. And then our friend Christian was with us, who's a big guy. And Jared is nice about it or whatever. I think his brother was probably pretty mad at me. I don't know if they were planning on beating me up or not. It seemed like his brother wanted to, but nothing happened. Fast forward a year later, we're on Warped Tour 2006, and Under Oath, I think, drops off, and 30 Seconds to Mars replaces them. And I'm walking to catering the last day of Warped Tour. I'm actually going to go have catering for lunch, and then I'm getting a cab to the airport to fly home. And I walk past Jared, and I sort of wave at him, and he simultaneously flips me off and says, hey, dude, what's up? And I have no idea how to take this. So I'm just sort of confused by it. Then, fast forward one more year, we have a break, and I'm visiting New York City. I'm staying with my friend Nicole, and she's at the Fashion Institute of Technology with like these beautiful girls studying fashion who are like way too cool for me, don't care about me. I'm not impressing them at all. And we're out at like a crepe place in the West or East Village at like 1 a.m. eating crepes in New York, as one does when one visits, you know, fashionista friends. And I'm trying to get these girls to just even think I'm funny or whatever, and it's not working. And someone says, hey, Dan, there's somebody out there like who's asking for you. It's like a guy in a hoodie, and I don't really recognize him. So I start doing this thing of like, you know, like the smile that like it must be a fan. And I probably met them at some point, but I don't want to be rude and like not remember who they are. So I'm like, hey, and I get there and it's Jared Leto standing outside, recognize me at the crepe place. Like, what is going on? And I was like, hey, dude, I thought you were, you know, kind of mad at me. He's like, no, it's all part of the act. And he's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm visiting. You know, I'm visiting a friend. I was like, what are you doing? He's like, just a little work, playing the VMAs. and then he left with his blonde date or whatever. And I went back in and I was like, these girls are going to think I'm cool now. Because they saw by that point that it was Jared Leto. This is the high point of my life socially. I went from feeling like such a dork around these girls to like, No, it's cool. You know, it's just Jared Leto. I just wanted to say what's up. So, you know, we're cool. We're just kind of burying the hatchet there. So ridiculous. I have no idea why he even remembered me. I mean, I never had a conversation with him one time before that. It's very weird. You know what's funny? I actually do have a theory about this. The things he said to me from the stage, he said, "Hey, Beardo," and he said, "Why don't you go back to England with your friends?" And at the time, my MySpace name was Beardy, not Beardo, and the band is called Sherwood, which sounds British. And I have this theory that, like, apparently he kind of likes having hecklers so he can, like, heckle back. It's kind of part of the act. I think he might have actually done a little homework on us beforehand, figured out who was at the show. I mean, I could be wrong, but it doesn't make sense why he would say, "Go back to England and call me Beardo." Like, it's not like people with beards are commonly referred to as Beardo. That's not a normal thing. That's the only conspiracy theory that I buy is my own one. Yeah. Not big into conspiracy theories, but I like that one.
In early 2006, Absolute Punk released a free EP, which had been downloaded over 30,000 times. Sherwood was one of the first bands to do this, and many would follow, switching from selling hard copies to digital free content.
Well, the thing that you have to keep in mind is it doesn't look all that different to us. We're still living in a shitty old RV, you know. Now we get $15 or $20 for food instead of $7 for food. We're still living with our parents, you know, when we're not on tour. But it was really helpful to do that. And honestly, all the credit for that goes to Nate, our singer. He convinced some Absolute Punk folks to do it. And we were the first band to do that. And then they started doing those like every week or every month. They would have bands give away music on their site. So that was really Nate's kind of visionary thing. And so it was something. My favorite story though about the people who downloaded that EP is when I met my wife, she was like, "Oh, what band are you in?" I was like, "Sherwood." She's like, "Oh, I've heard of you guys. I downloaded that EP." And I was like, "What'd you think of it?" She said, "I never listened to it." And I was like, "I'm into you. That's a good answer." You know? So now we got to think, well, what, 15,000 people listen to it maybe if we're, you know, for being generous. The thing that stands out to me most now is that there is just such a glut of options. There's basically infinite options for everything, for movies, for music to listen to, for podcasts, for books. And so the only really safe thing is to be totally excellent in whatever you're making, or to be super niche and just there are some people who really like this and no one else is going to put the time in to do this thing. So I don't know. It's certainly changed a lot. I recently had a friend ask me for advice on how to get their career going as a band. And I was like, dude, I have no idea. Like, what we did 14 years ago is really different than surely what people should do now, you know?
Later in the year, Sherwood surprised fans with an announcement of a new partnership with MySpace Records, and subsequently spent 6 weeks in Mexico at a beach house recording songs for the new album. What was it like in paradise, and was it hard to deal with the pressure of prior success?
Mexico happened for two reasons. Number one is that Nate realized that I would only work on music if there were no distractions around. So he was basically managing my attention span, which was very wise of him. He's totally right about that. And so then the question was, well, where should we go? And actually, Mexico was cheaper than California because there was this string of houses on this one particular giant beach. It's like a huge bay, like almost the size of Monterey Bay for people who know California. And what happened apparently is that some California con men built like 250 homes here, maybe more, and sold them to Americans fraudulently on land that they didn't own. And then the Mexican guy who owned the land found out, and basically the Mexican army came in and said, "You guys have to leave. You have two choices. You can leave, or you can renegotiate your mortgage with the owner of the land, the guy who really owns the land." And so some people stayed and renegotiated their mortgages. Other people burnt their houses down, threw rocks at their own windows. like in a huff, like in a rage. So there's this like insane stretch of coastline where like every fourth house is burned down. But the other houses are great, you know? And so we rented a house for 6 weeks on the ocean. Like pods of dolphins swam by four or five times that we saw. And we got that whole thing for like $3,000 for 6 weeks. And it was insane. I mean, it was in 2006, so it's a little more expensive now, I'm sure. But it was actually cheap. And I loved that experience. That's one of my favorite memories of the band. I mean, we just would go get tacos. Joe and I would like drink Red Label and watch movies until late and then get up and start tracking stuff. Joe was kind of like my, I don't know, engineer. And then we would just sort of take turns working on things, but it was mostly, you know, he and I kept the computer running on something most of the time. And I just have such good memories from that time, man. That was the best. Yeah, that's probably the first time we felt any pressure like to actually succeed at something. There would be expectations, definitely. But I think that, you know, the change between the records was mostly that A Different Light was slicker, you know, it was like more heavily produced and it was more pop and it was kind of less indie, less Beach Boys. And I think that was always going to happen. I think that's kind of where I wanted to go. I regret a little bit of that now, not totally, but I wanted to make a record that Reliant K fans would like. And also I think that our guitar player leaving, he was kind of the weirder element guitar wise for the first record. He would write the kind of angular parts. And so I think, you know, I did a little bit of like Mars Volta after At the Drive-In type thing, thinking, well, I don't need that angularity. You know, I can just write pop songs. I don't need you, Chris, which is a little naive, but you know, so there was pressure. I do think that we wrote, I mean, I think Song in My Head is probably the best song that we wrote. So in a sense, we met that pressure at least as well as we were able to as a band. And, you know, it worked. I mean, we went on tour that whole next year and we did three US tours in 2007 and made a lot of fans. I mean, I still meet people today who saw us with Reliant K in 2007 and remember that show.
2007 and 2008 saw Dan and the band touring with some pretty great acts in support of A Different Light. That meant some crazy different experiences for Dan going all over the world with bands like Reliant K, May, Hello Goodbye, and Say Anything, including one that he says changed his life.
So there's 2 years. 2007 is when A Different Light comes out. We do full U.S. tour with Reliant K, full U.S. tour with Motion City Soundtrack, and then full U.S. tour with The Academy Is, back to back to back, with like a week off in between each of those. I think we played, I don't know, 170 shows that year or something like that. So that was pretty amazing. I mean, and then 2008 is when we went to the U.K. three times and Japan once, and then we did a headlining tour of the U.S. with The Matches, as co-headlining with The Matches, and then I think Houston Calls on the East Coast. I mean, so 08 going around the world is probably my favorite year. Just like such a great experience. I'm a bit of a travel nerd, and so it was just awesome to see a lot of places. And I have various sort of funny memories from that time, like our tour manager in England bumping into things with our car and just going, "It's a rental," but basically hitting and running cars in parking lots. But that's really funny to me now. Or like taking the ferry back from Ireland to England at 6:30 a.m. And a bunch of people were on their way to a rugby tournament, and the bar on the ferry was full of people drinking at 6:30 in the morning, and just being like, "Oh gosh, I'm in a different place right now." But my favorite kind of way of summing up. So the funny thing is, like, still financially, there's very little going on, you know, compared to our friends who at this point are like have jobs. So At the end of Reliant K tour, we sold so many t-shirts on that tour. And Reliant K made us charge the same amount that they charged for their t-shirts, which at first we were worried about. We sold t-shirts for $15, they sold them for $20. But it turned out to be a huge blessing because Reliant K fans are happy to pay $20 a shirt. And so we each get a check for $7,500 at the end of this tour. But this is 2007. So I, like the weird kid with a conscience that I was, put all that money into what is called a socially responsible mutual fund. And then the 2008 financial crisis happened, and I lost half of it, and I was down to $3,700. And then 1 year later, I got married, and I bought my wife a ring, and I booked our hotel and flights for our honeymoon, and I was broke. That was it. But it was all the Reliant K money. It lasted me till I got married, and I spent the last of it. I spent the last of it on the honeymoon. Yeah. So in 2008, one of the most surreal moments of my life, I almost hesitate to tell this story because it sounds like I'm gloating, but I don't really think I did anything to deserve this moment. It's just a crazy moment. So don't take it as gloating. So I miss my flight to Japan because I'm in Seattle visiting my wife, I think. I was dating her at the time. And so I miss the connection to San Francisco, and I miss the flight to Tokyo. So I stay overnight in San Francisco, and I catch the morning flight to Tokyo. But everyone else is already there. They pick me up in a minivan. There's no sign. Someone just sort of recognized me, threw me into a minivan. They drive me through the streets of Tokyo for 20, 30 minutes and park right next to the stage at this festival, this Uprising Festival that we're playing. And they put me directly on stage for sound check. So I'm jet lagged. I just flew 13 hours from San Francisco. We have sound check. Then I go backstage and we're sharing a dressing room with Plain White Tees, who were buddies of ours as well at the time. And Nate is there from Sherwood. He starts telling me the story. He's like, dude, you missed the craziest moment. I was at dinner at the table with catering with Fat Mike from NoFX, who Nate also had become acquaintances with the singer of the Buzzcocks, who is like one of the first four punk bands from England in the 70s, like totally massively influential band that had reunited. And I don't know, Tim Armstrong from Rancid. And Nate's just a fly on the wall, so I'm hearing this secondhand from Nate. But apparently, Fat Mike and the singer of the Buzzcocks were talking, and the Buzzcocks guy's like, oh yeah, what's your band? And he's like, oh, it's called NoFX. And he's like, oh, I'll have to look you up. Like, the singer of the Buzzcocks does not know who NoFX is, and it's like the best moment of Nate's life to see that. Anyway, so then we play our set, which goes pretty well. We never did super well in Japan, but it was great to be able to go there once. And then I'm on side stage for the headliner, which is Rancid. So I grew up on Rancid. I grew up on Operation Ivy, Bay Area ska punk band. And I'm watching as my friend Fat Mike goes out to take the microphone. To my right is Tom DeLonge from Angels and Airwaves. To my left is my band and Plain White Tees guys. And I'm watching Fat Mike sing Knowledge by Operation Ivy with Rancid to 20,000 Japanese teenagers. Mind you, I'm still jet lagged as all get out, and probably had been drinking whatever beer was backstage. And I just had this moment of like, where the hell am I right now? What is going on? This is like the craziest moment of my life. And I think musically it has remained the craziest moment of my life. It's just so surreal.
In 2009, Sherwood would release their third full-length record, Q.
For Q, I think that we were probably a little dissatisfied with being a scene band, being a kind of an emo pop band, and we wanted to flex our muscles a little bit. We wanted to try artistic stuff we hadn't tried. And, you know, so that's why there's kind of a diversity of sonic palette on that record. There's sampled drums, there's kind of you know, a lot more instruments. There's some stuff that's heavier on the piano, and Brad Wood really was a perfect fit, the producer for that record. You know, so I think we accomplished that. I think also, though, that we were starting to get tired of the life. You know, at that point, it had been 4 years of touring and recording about 10 or 11 months out of the year, every year. And so, you know, I remember just really wanting an apartment. Like, I really wanted to live in an apartment and not be on the road. And I don't know how much that played into the writing process, but, you know, I think that, so that record, is still my favorite Sherwood record, definitely. But I think that two things were a problem, in terms of that record succeeding. Number one is that MySpace, by the time that record came out, no longer meant what it had meant before. Now it was Facebook. I mean, MySpace had already lost to Facebook by that point. So when A Different Light came out, you know, we could get 750,000 plays of a song on Tom Anderson's profile page in 24 hours. That was not going to happen in 2009, 2 years later. And we had no Facebook presence, we had no Twitter presence, because we were contractually not allowed to. So we were behind. Yeah, we were behind on all these other accounts. And we had trained our fans, hey, whenever we're going to do anything, you'll get a MySpace message. You'll get a MySpace message, because they would send them for us, you know, which you couldn't just do that as a normal band account. That was one of the perks of being on their record label, was having direct access to your MySpace friends. So that was a problem. And then, you know, our own fault, we didn't write any songs that were sort of as single worthy as Song in My Head was, for instance. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of woulda, shoulda, coulda. I know that our managers later told me that they wish that they had pushed MySpace to take Song in My Head to radio rather than waiting for a song from Q to go to radio. And that would have made some difference. I mean, would it mean that we were the All-American Rejects? I don't think so. It would have made some difference, but we never would have, you know. I don't stay up thinking about that.
Around 2010, rumors started to brew that the band was breaking up, but these rumors were met with some denial and promise of more music. However, they ended up breaking up after all.
Basically, what happened was, sometime in late 2010 or 2011, early 2011, in the same week, MySpace Records closed officially, and our managers quit. They said, look, we love you guys. We gave this a go. We're not going to be able to work with you anymore. And so that precipitated a conversation among the band. Basically, David at that point left. He said, you know, I've loved it, but I want to go back to school. And I can't tour anymore. I'll make a record if you want to make a record, but I'm not going to tour. So the four of us remaining, Mike, Joe, Nate, and I, basically formed into two camps. Two of us wanted to do it part-time, make records and tour here and there. The other two wanted us to move to one city together and really make a go of it, you know, move somewhere more central like Nashville, where you're an eight-hour drive from 20 different markets. And we really couldn't agree. And in the meantime, we did a lot of sort of bitter emailing with each other. We didn't handle it very well communication-wise. And, you know, friendships really suffered, and eventually we called it. We called it in 2012, but we hadn't done anything for a year and a half at that point. And yeah, I didn't talk to Nate for really much for a couple years after that. And it was kind of a rough end, actually. Yeah. So Nate and I each had one of the other guys on our side, and, yeah. And so that's a bummer. I mean, the thing I regret most about it is just how poorly we communicated and how quick we were to like fire off an email that was hurtful, you know, rather than getting on the phone and talking it out, you know.
After parting ways, each of the band members went their own way to pursue their own career, until 2015 comes along and bam, an announcement drops on Facebook that the band was getting back together and planned to crowdfund a whole new album using Indiegogo.
By 2012, I think I'd finished up college and I was already living in Seattle for two or three years. And then I ended up becoming, and still am, a commercial composer. So I write production music for TV ads and stuff like that. DanCoke.net, if any of you happen to work at ad agencies. So I did that. And so I kind of kept my foot, you know, in music and was one of the lucky ones who found a way to make it as a living. And so that was there. And I was learning more about writing songs because I was writing for all these different genres for work. And then in the meanwhile, Nate and I, after a year or two kind of break, sort of resumed our friendship. And we just started talking on the phone, just calling, chatting. He'd had a kid, you know, in the meanwhile. And we started seeing more eye to eye on a lot of things. I don't want to intimate that, like, oh, I convinced him. It isn't like that. It's more like the places that we were each going mentally, sort of thinking about growing up and becoming more mature. Really, we had like all this overlap. And so we sort of started talking like, well, you know, we had this band. Could we write songs about this stuff? And really, if you pay attention to the lyrics on the last record, there's a lot in there about just kind of making the transition from adolescence to adulthood, and which is not particularly common fodder for the type of music that we play. But that's really what got the conversation going again, was renewing that friendship and realizing that we had sort of a shared vision of what we wanted to say. And that was real. That had never been how Sherwood was. Sherwood songs started as little hooks, melodic hooks that maybe had some sound, that some words that sounded right, and then I would sort of go from there and just finish it and make it into something. I'd never started with a lyric. I never had started with something I wanted to say. And so that was interesting on this last record. A lot of the songs were started by Nate. He started some little fragment of a thing he wanted to say. For instance, Together Alone, which is a song about people on their phones at parties, you know, people sort of in their devices all the time and not spending time with each other. That started out as something Nate wanted to say, and then he wrote a chorus, and we went from there. So that's kind of a long answer, but that's kind of how it got going again. Yeah. Nate had been all in on the crowdfunding trend, like, since it started. Like, he was a big believer in that when Kickstarter started getting going. And so we had sort of always known that we would do that. We figured we were savvy enough to reach out directly to our fans. We could raise enough money for the record. And so we just kind of knew we'd do that. And with BC Music, they didn't care. That's what they do for their bands anyway. So they didn't really mind that we ran our own campaign. They helped us a bit, actually. Matt McDonald, who sings for the Classic Crime, also works, basically runs BC Music, and so he helped us with that crowdfunding campaign, and he's also one of my best friends. And then working with them was just like, hey, these are our friends. They're doing this thing. They have this podcast and this label, and, you know, surely they will help us get the word out to people about the record, and so we just decided to give them a shot. But we actually never signed any contract. We never signed a deal. It's just all, we just talked about it, which is kind of nice. The main thing about the record was actually from the fans. It was nice to have enough money to be able to do drums in a nice studio and hire a really competent producer and engineer to do the record. That was like, made the record so much more fun to make, especially for me. But the thing that's really been crazy has been playing these shows. So what we decided to do was do this record, and then we knew that when we did the record, we would play some reunion shows. And so, for instance, you know, in 2016, we did the West Coast in the summer, and we hadn't played there since 2010. So basically a 6-year gap between the shows. And those have been incredible. I mean, we've done two of these now. We did it that year, and then we did the Midwest last year, last fall. And those weeks, you know, it's about a week of shows we do, have been the best week of the year, both of those years, for me. And so what's, I don't know exactly what's so great about that. I mean, there's a part of it that's, it's fun to go back on tour again and be a kid again. But I think it's more talking to the fans and old friends who come out. And now some people, that line is really blurred because, you know, these are people we would stay with whenever we were in town and we became friends with them. Or even if they're people that weren't that close with, they're such familiar faces and, you know, we've kept in some touch. And I don't know, man, I heard some stories too of like people who said that, you know, when one of our records came out, they were, you know, deeply depressed and it got them through high school. And, you know, I'm like now 34 showing up for a week of shows, drinking beers with my buddies. And then I get hit with a story like that. And, you know, it's so far from my current experience, you know, being a married guy with a job and a mortgage. And then to go do this and just be like, oh my gosh, that's right. Like, this actually impacted people. It impacted me. Like, it reminds me of all the ways that I changed, you know, becoming a man, being the kind of person who could marry a good woman and treat her well, becoming the kind of person who could take criticism, you know, becoming, and then so to just be able to, you know, play the songs, but then also talk to the fans again has, I mean, it sounds cheesy, but it's really been like the highlight of my year, the last 2 years. And I'm really looking forward to next fall when we do the East Coast.
After all this time, the big question now is, what's next for the band?
The tour is all we've got for now. We haven't written any songs for another album. It's certainly not off the table. It's not something that we're focused on right now. My creative projects are more in the podcasting world right now. So guys, I actually, dear listeners, I host two podcasts. I co-host a podcast on theology. It's called Reconstruct. And I host a podcast on politics, psychology, and religion called Depolarize. And those are both on the Bad Christian Podcast Network. And they're all on, you know, iTunes and Stitcher and everything. This song that you're going to hear is called The Unknown. It is the last track on the most recent record, Some Things Never Leave You. And it's kind of the song that sums up the kind of life journey that Nate and I were really talking through that led to us making the record. So I think it's a good one to play. It's also, it might be the loudest Sherwood song we've ever written, which I also like.
Two hands hold my father's cup. One says drink, the other's stuck on everything I've tried to push away, push away. When the devil whispered in my ear that I could live a thousand years if I stay on the straight and narrow way. It's in these bones, but some people never see. They won't wake up from the dream and go it alone unless we grow. Transform in others' eyes, cascading butterflies into the unknown, into the unknown. This one.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Yep, we hear you. Let's get you some beautiful windows that won't warp at warp speed. Durable, weather-friendly Vibrex windows and a seamless professional process. A free, no-pressure renewal by Andersen consultation is just a call or click away. When it's time to talk windows, we'll bring the wisdom. Renewal by Andersen.